As I mentioned at the beginning of class, I'll talk today about concentration and insight. Hopeful to illuminate how they work together and are mutually supportive, and also the ways that they're different, to allow you to practice both and move between them in real time as if they are modes of one integrated practice. It's worth, I think, highlighting or underscoring the basic fact that we do have many different types of meditation practices, concentration being one, arguably, and mindfulness or insight meditation being another. Other examples would include loving kindness, equanimity, for example, compassion. So there are many different, and then if we step outside of the Buddhist tradition, of course, there are even more types of, or styles, or techniques of meditation practice. What we are being exposed to in the Dharma centers that most of us are visiting and in the books that we're reading is a combination, usually, of concentration and insight practice. And it's not always clear to practitioners what the difference is and how they work together. And in that sense, we could argue, and this doesn't have to be critical or negative or pessimistic, but in that sense, sometimes we're winging it a little bit. And probably what we're doing, even if that's the case, has some short-term and long-term benefit. However, as many of you are finding out, this being meditation is a legitimate skill to be complemented by understanding, and it matures over time as our conceptual grasp and our circumstances experientially build upon one another, and we become more skilled ultimately over time. So concentration practice is intended to concentrate the mind. It is intended to gather the attention in one place. It is intended to stabilize the mind. It is a stabilizing practice. So we attempt or aim to concentrate or stabilize the mind as a general rule for the sake of stability, for the sake of concentration itself. It's fair to say, in doing that, that we are focusing on one thing at the exclusion of other things. This is important, and this is going to help us understand the difference between insight and concentration. We are focusing on one thing at the exclusion of other things, and perhaps every other thing. So what is a thing? The language we use in the Dharma is objects or anchors. And there are innumerable objects and anchors, and they are all of the various things that present themselves to the six sense doors. Okay? Seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, feeling, and cognizing. And as you know, there are a lot of inner and outer objects or stimuli that present themselves at any of those six sense doors, right? So just today, in this short period of meditation, I noticed that my mind was evaluating a relationship in my life, thinking about what I would do later this afternoon and this evening, to include at one point what I would eat for dinner. I was comparing two different bikes in my head and their specific geometry with regard to which one would be a more suitable bike to buy. I was aware that the body was a little bit tight. Just, I did a lot of exercise yesterday, and there's just some general tightness, but also really no pain, and sometimes I sit with pain, so I was aware of what was going on in the body. And intermittently, I would keep coming back to the breath, and just there it is, breathing in, breathing out. And the closer I was to the breath, all that other stuff would start to fade to the background, right? And then a thought would come in, and at one point I thought about my parents who are traveling, and my thought would come in. And usually when that happens, I lose touch with the body, or lose touch with the breath. That's a short list of, you know, I can't remember everything that presented itself during that 30 or 35 minute period of meditation. But you get the picture, because your minds were probably doing similar things. That's what happens when we sit down. And some of you might have had a more stable or concentrated mind. And there were times when I held the breath for quite some time, and you know, the body relaxed more, and it grew quieter. One thing I was aware of was these air filters, which have historically been completely silent, and they are, as far as I can tell, on silent mode, but they're getting louder over the years. This one in particular, I try to remember now to unplug it when I come in the room, but I usually forget. And today, for the first time, I chose to get up during the meditation practice and unplug it. Audibly, I thought it was just a little bit too much for the room, and once I did that, I realized that another one was also making noise.
Right.
So there's a lot to be aware of, right? And the object of my meditation, not the intention, not my goals associated with meditation, the object, the thing that I was observing, was my breath. So if concentration is to choose an object to pay attention to at the exclusion of others, in my case, what I was trying to pay attention to was the breath, the inhalation and the exhalation, cyclically. And therefore, when my mind wandered anywhere, when I became aware of any other object, I was to bring my attention back to the breath. And to repeat that as often as necessary, which in the course of a meditation period is usually many times. Less times, however, as the mind grows more concentrated, because as the mind grows more concentrated, it can stay with the object with greater ease and for longer duration. So remember, the purpose of concentration is to become concentrated. There are byproducts of that, such as lightness of body, peace, rapture, pitti, which is a very high quality of energy, kind of like a buzzy energy. So there are these well-being, there are these characteristics of well-being, the kinds of things. You hear these words, peace, bliss, rapture, pitti, you're probably thinking, oh, that sounds pretty good, right? They are generally enjoyable experiences. They generally feel good in the mind and the body. And so they are one way that we can measure our experience or our progress. It's one way we can understand whether the mind is concentrated or not. They are those feel-good mental states, mental and physical states, are also called the corruptions of insight. The corruptions of insight. So we begin to get a sense with this, with the introduction of this term, that there's something else going on or that there's more for us. And to say they are the corruptions of insight does not mean that they are inherently problematic or bad, but they can be a sort of trap. If we have a conventional mind, we live an ordinary life, and we have ordinary stress like every other person does, and or we have more acute stress or emotional or mental difficulties, and we begin to learn meditation, then all of a sudden we start to have experiences of peace, bliss, rapture, stability of mind, lightness of body. Often, what students determine is that they're doing it. They're successful in their practice. And they are also the corruptions of insight because for thousands of years, historically, meditators, initially beginning with monastics, took those states to be awakening, took those states to be liberation, freedom. They're not. They are the result of concentration. The concentrated mind feels those various states of well-being that are enjoyable or pleasant. So also historically, practitioners have therefore become literally addicted to those states, like trying to make it happen again. And it's very common to meet people who are learning meditation and begin to have a relationship with them, and you know, 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, 12 months, 2 years go by, and you might, there might be an opportunity to talk to them about their goals. What do you want from your practice? And they start to explain things like that. I want my mind to be quiet. I want to feel at peace. I want my mind to be at ease. That's great. That's fine. Those are goals associated with various types of meditation practice. They are not necessarily synonymous with insight, which is the ability to reduce or eliminate suffering in one's life. Do you understand that? You see that? It's important to know that. If one experiences distress in any way, dukkha, and or through their behavior causes it for other people, and then develops the ability to be concentrated and feels good during their meditation, that does not mean that when they're not meditating, they are not going to cause stress for themselves and other people. Though they might be even more inclined to think that they're not, which becomes a form of spiritual bypassing, right? The sense that, like, I know something or have some skill that others don't have. You know, I'm improving in a particular way. So if those states are both valid, reputable, worthy, even commendable, despite that caution that I just offered, even commendable mind states, because they do indicate progress. We're learning something. We're developing a skill if we're experiencing those states. If they are also the corruptions of insight, we need to then talk about what insight is, how that functions, and how it's different than these concentrated states. So the purpose of mindfulness meditation or insight meditation is to have insight. To have moments of insight that lead to wisdom, which is information or understanding, that would reduce or eliminate dukkha, distress, dis-ease, suffering, discontent. So this is the path of wisdom, whereby one has the inner perspective or skills to create significant fundamental change in their lives in terms of how they relate to their own mind, which therefore also results in behavioral changes that have them being a far more suitable or kind or wise or hospitable person to be around. Something begins to change. This person over time is not only capable and qualified and competent in the 30 minutes that they're meditating, but in the other 23 and a half hours a day when they're out in the world doing the things that they do. Doesn't mean that this person becomes perfect or doesn't make mistakes. All of our habitual conditioning is very, very strong, and it takes months, years, decades, lifetimes to work through some of our conditioning. So the wise person is still impatient and unskillful and hostile. Sometimes we can't expect of even advanced meditators to be perfect, though hopefully, and it's fair to hold one another accountable to gradual progress over time. We should actually be able to demonstrate some skill, some improving skill as a human being. So if when practicing concentration one focuses on an object at the exclusion of other objects, again, that's simply to stabilize the mind, right? The opposite is true for mindfulness or for insight meditation. Meaning specifically that once some concentration is developed, so that our attention is not getting pulled away to all, you know, past thinking, future thinking, analysis of the present moment. The mind is just, once we have some relative control of the mind is starting to feel relatively stable. We can hold the anchor. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Mind becomes stable. Invariably, despite that stability, other objects will present themselves. Thoughts, bodily sensation, pleasant or unpleasant. Sound, rubber car tires going by on the road, rain hitting the roof, doesn't matter. Remember, the instructions with regard to concentration are to, when that occurs, to bring the attention back to the anchor, which most of us learn how to do. That's how we're first taught to meditate, and we get pretty good at doing that, which is beneficial. That's one of the core foundations of our practice. If we've made a transition to insight or mindfulness, we don't have to do that anymore. We can, but we don't have to, right? We can observe. Practicing insight would be to observe the object that has risen to, we could say, investigate its true nature, which is synonymous with the notion of insight. And so we observe that object as the new object of our attention until it is not an object of our attention anymore because it has been replaced by another object, which will happen because the nature of objects is to come and go, to rise and pass away. They are all conditioned phenomena, and no conditioned phenomena is permanent. So practicing insight meditation is like watching a movie and the scenes change, correct? For those of you who have ever watched a movie or a television show or a sporting event, the scene changes, okay, right? Now, if you want to practice concentration, you hit the pause button. And you just watch the gal standing in front of the car for an hour. That's it. You just watch the girl standing in front of the red car. That's it. Don't hit play. Don't take your eye off the TV. Just watch. It doesn't matter if you, well, I was going to open up a can of worms there. Just watch the girl standing in front of the red car. That's it. Okay? Now, if I ring the bell 10, 12 minutes into meditation practice, and you have been offered or it's been suggested that you might at that point now start to practice insight meditation, you hit the play button on the remote control. And now the girl walks away from the car drives away, and a big bus comes along full of people. And you watch that all happen. And then the bus drives by, and behind the bus is a beach, and there's a bunch of people on surfboards, they're surfing on the beach. It starts to rain, you're aware of the rain, and then the music starts playing. So now you're listening to the music. So you're watching the natural movements. You're watching the scenes change in that film. When we get adept or skilled at doing this, we can, with a steady, impartial, non-preferential, observant mind, watch each object come and go according to their natural proclivities and timeline. And we see very plainly, very simply, and with extraordinary consistency, that all objects at all sense doors are not only temporary, but very temporary. That they come and they go. They rise and they pass away. And this is a challenge presented to us as meditators. Is that statement true? Is this true? And what we find is that this statement is unequivocally accurate. Right? And we begin to see, depending on the quality of mind that is observing the object, the degree of stability, we begin to notice even more nuanced information. That the sense, experientially, the felt sense of self that is doing the observing or hearing the sounds or feeling the physical pain or thinking about the future, that thing, that feeling, that experience is sometimes very solid and concrete, palpable, and sometimes very thin and amorphous, barely perceptible. So there's objects, and there's awareness, and there's the felt sense of the thing that is seeing or hearing or feeling or tasting or touching or cognizing. And these are all different examples of conditioned phenomena that have varying degrees of solidity to them. In the degree to which we cling or attach or get invested in the thoughts and feelings and sensations and memories and bodily pains and ideas and worries and fears, that felt sense of a concrete, solid thing, which is me or I, Chris, teacher, son, brother, husband, that thing just becomes more and more emboldened. And as that happens, dukkha is on the increase. We're watching that happen. Awareness is behind all of that construction of form, observing it happen. Or it's just inside it, invisible to awareness. The self is just inside that, invisible to itself. So awareness is watching all of this happen. Likewise, as awareness observes impartially, without preference, with curiosity and interest and equanimity, all of these various objects rising and passing away at all of the six sense doors, without getting invested or attached or glomming on in any way, what we notice is that there is not much of a self, literally. That other entity, that other object, which is observable by way of a felt sense of me or I to which things are happening, that is changing on a scale from lesser to greater solidity or being present at all, right? And when that felt sense of self is robust, concrete, solid, there is a parallel scale on which the dukkha is very high, right? Dukkha is distress, stress, dis-ease, suffering. When we are practicing insight meditation, we still might have a primary anchor. And a primary anchor might be the anchor that you're most used to working with. It might be the anchor that you started your meditation practice with. For those of you who did the exercise today, whatever anchor object you were focused on in the first 10 or however many minutes of the practice, that might have continued to be your primary anchor throughout the whole meditation period. What might that look like or feel like? Well, if you're practicing concentration, we're hoping that 100%, 90% of your attention is on the anchor. When you transition to insight, you open the attention wider, literally. Like if I'm practicing concentration, I can only see that one cushion. I'm only observing that one cushion. And as I begin to open, literally open or widen or expand my attention, okay, I can now see three cushions and Max on top of his cushion. I can expand my attention more to now see five cushions, Jen and Arlene, and I can see the beginning outlines of people sitting behind the front row. However, 40 or 50% of my attention is still on my primary anchor. So I'm rooted or grounded. My attention is not entirely floating about in space. It is for me 20, 30, 40, 50% on my breath or some aspect of my body or just my whole body. So there's part of the attention is still rooted, grounded in an anchor, but not 90, not 100. My attention is open. And then I can open my attention to the whole room. I can see every cushion, every person, the windows, the walls, the lights, the ceiling. And if any of these objects at any time become too much, meaning they pull me away and to some fantasy regarding where I'm going to live when I'm 65 years old and how much money is going to be in my bank account and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I can just come back and observe that one object and restabilize my attention, regather the mind, refocus, reconcentrate, And then when I feel that the mind is stable, I can then open again. So I refer to insight practice or Vipassana practice as concentration hyphen insight. They are separate practices. There's teachings for one, there's teachings for the other. It's very difficult to do one without the other. So they are therefore also like modes. They're mode, right? I can be a little bit over on the concentration end of the spectrum, or I can be a little bit over on the mindfulness or insight end of the spectrum. And in any period of time, I may need to expand or open my attention or narrow it based on how stable the mind is. So an insight meditator is gauging or evaluating the stability of mind and knows that it can keep the attention open or wide, or has to narrow it, has to narrow the focus in order to strengthen the concentration. And you can choose to just stay there, concentrating the mind and enjoying the feeling of that, or you can open the attention again. So I think I'll stop there and we can have some discussion and clarify anything else or that needs to be, we can talk about anything that will be helpful to improve our understanding of this.